Okay, Mr. Turner, what year were you born?
1916.
And where?
Hong Kong.
In Hong Kong?
Right.
Oh. Well, how did you come to Canada then?
By boat.
What was the reason?
Well, no, my father was overseas in the Far East with the Canadian YMCA.
Oh, I see. What was your father's occupation?
Teacher.
Mm-hmm. And is your father of Canadian background?
No, he came from Yorkshire. He's the only one that came over.
When did he come to Canada?
1908. Mm-hmm. He's alive, he's 91 and a half.
And where do you live when he's in Canada?
Well, I lived in Ontario and then the prairies and out here.
And when did he go to the Far East?
I'm not sure. I think it was 1907 or 1908, one of those two.
And
he was in Korea, Shanghai, Canton, and Hong Kong.
And how long were you in the Near East before he came back?
Not long.
When did he come back to Canada?
I came back at my mother brought me back when I was 17 months old with the Empress of Japan at Sydney Stanley Park. I'll figure it in there.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Came back to Vancouver.
Right. Well, then we went from Vancouver to Ontario for I don't know how many years, and then we went from Ontario to Vancouver. And then I grew up partly Vancouver, partly Penticton, partly Haney, and back to Vancouver.
Mm-hmm. And your schooling then was in B.C., though, eh?
B.C., oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which high school did you go to?
Kitsilano, I guess.
Yeah. And you went to UBC in 1935? That was your first year?
I'm not sure. 34, 35. I think it was 34.
Mm-hmm. And you were in the... Which faculty were you in?
Well, I was in the Faculty of Arts. That included the Commerce in those days. Commerce is now a separate faculty, but the Faculty of Arts. I took Arts and Commerce, double degree course.
What was it like at UBC in the 1930s? What do you remember of the campus in the 30s?
Well, it was a little smaller than today. It was about 2,000 students.
2,000, yeah.
And it was a much smaller place. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, most of the people in Arts and Commerce knew most of the people, and plus the odd engineer, etc.
I suppose compared to today, you would have really you could almost get to know your classmates.
Oh yeah, you would know them as long as you were in one class. You certainly wouldn't know them in the big class, like English. Dr. Sedgwick had 200 or 300, and Freddie Wood had 200 or 300 in his class.
Yeah. Yeah.
But oh yeah, sure, you knew the people. You meet them in the cup of calf club in the cafeteria. Cub.
Of course, these are depression times too, and I wonder what sort of signs of the depression there would have been on campus. For example,
well, you had to get loans if you needed them from Walter Gage, who was at that time and still is the head of the student loans. You had to get part-time summer job, which I did. You had to get some help from your parents, which I did. You did all those things in order to keep going, sure. Mm-hmm. But I think we had a lot of fun because we didn't have much money, so therefore you'd make your own fun more that way.
What, for example, would have you done that one wouldn't do today to make your own fun?
Today?
What would you have done in those times, in the 30s, that you wouldn't do today?
Well, I think we're much more active in planning a social function than we would be today. We'd have many meetings and a lot of people would be mixed up in the decision as what we're going to do or not going to do and what we're going to have, and we would have probably skits or that type of thing featuring people in our own group, that kind of thing. We'd be much more concerned with trying to plan other outings or picnics or that sort of thing that we wouldn't do today. We would, I don't know, maybe we would spend about the same amount of time in a pub that they did do now, I could tell you.
Did you belong to campus organizations?
Did I belong to a campus organization?
Yes.
Well, I played basketball. I belonged to UBC staff.
The newspaper.
That's right. And, well, I belong to the Big Block Club, and I belong to the Arch Aggie Committee, and a few other things like that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Another feature of 1930s, of course, was the increasing sort of international tensions. I wonder what you perceived as a student at this time.
Well, there's one function I forgot to mention, Alan. We had a lot of fun. Once a year, we had a snake parade down through the downtown Vancouver. You heard of that before?
No, I haven't.
The university officially frowned on such activity, but it would happen once a year as part of the freshman initiation program. And we would have a snake parade through the downtown Vancouver, and most of the movie houses would stop and so on, and the streetcars would pull them off tracks and so forth. And the student president would demand that we don't do this anymore and so forth.
Snake parade?
Just a parade right through the downtown streets of Vancouver, just celebrating a part of their initiation program.
Hazing
in those days, it was called.
Why the term snake?
Well, because we maneuvered in that fashion.
Oh, I get it. Oh, I see.
Snake parade. Mm-hmm. And it was very unofficial and frowned upon. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure they didn't do much good public relations right to downtown people.
Uh-huh.
Now, sorry, you go back to your other question.
Yes, I'm wondering what you perceived of international developments in the 30s.
Well, about the only concern was the manner in which Hitler particularly and Mussolini were arbitrarily moving in on countries. Nobody apparently stopping them. This wasn't right. The biggest probable thing was a sigh of relief, and that would be the way to express it, I guess. When Chamberlain went over to Munich and came back and said we're having peace in our time, and we believed it, so why shouldn't we believe it?
Yes.
But no, there was that. There was also the realization that most of us were very social reform conscious. There should be better ways to overcome some of the problems in Canada. And those were the days where either you became a liberal rather than perhaps a very ultra-conservative in your political thinking, or you became more radical and joined different kinds of organizations that were starting up, whether they were Social Credit or CCF or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, because...
It was sort of a politically active...
Oh, yeah. Most people were talking about things like that.
Yes.
And they were worried about jobs, really. That's what they were worried about. Where are they going to go when they're finished?
Mm.
You know, this is very real. And it perhaps was less true of those in the professions than it was in people in arts, even arts and commerce, because there weren't that many business openings for commerce graduates in those days.
Mm-hmm. You didn't join the COTC?
No.
Why not?
Well, in high school, I wouldn't even join a cadet corps at that time. I was under the impression that World War I finished all wars, and I was very pleased to hear that. I felt there should be peace, and so I wouldn't even join a cadet corps. The mm-hmm. second reason was that at UBC I was far too busy. In my opinion, to be joining anything other than what I was doing, basketball practices two or three times a week and games once a week. UBC came out twice a week, that was the student newspaper which I was involved in, and makeups and information on that, plus a certain amount of part-time job, because I got a downtown press job as well to supplement my income, so I didn't really have too much additional time, even if I'd wanted to join the OTC.
Mm-hmm. But you wouldn't have because of your attitude?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. Basically, I wasn't interested in that. No, I had one or two friends that were in it.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, I think that their backgrounds were, they had relations in it, or that type of life appealed to them, that's all.
They had relations, you mean?
Relatives, or fathers, or uncles, or grandparents, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I suspect this anyway.
Yeah.
Plus the fact they like to get dressed up in a uniform and march around.
Mm-hmm. So what year did you graduate?
39.
What did you do then?
Well, I went to work for the News Herald, which is a defunct morning newspaper now.
Uh-huh.
And that was the education itself. It, in those days, it was so small that it was possible to meet the other members of the university, at least a member of the newspaper world, in that paper and learn something about it. The makeup men, the downstairs, the line type operators, the advertising people, the circulation department, and so on, which you can't do today, but you could meet them firsthand. This is we're talking now, and say, what do you do, and how do you do it? And what are these district managers? And what do they do, and how do they do it? So.
Why did you stay with newspaper work?
Well, I didn't feel after a length of time that I would that I was necessarily going to go ahead there. I was still in sport, and I was also doing part-time general reporting and things like Elgo Junior Choir recitals and obituaries going on police court. It didn't really, the glamour, I suppose, had worn off, but I wasn't moving ahead fast enough in the editorial side to satisfy me. So I went, I had worked previously peddling groceries and peddling a bike for the W.H. Malt Company, and so I had been able to get a summertime job with them, so I thought, well, I'll go with them full-time. So I did.
How did the work affect your life?
How did it affect my life?
Yes.
Boy, that's a tough one. I lost some people that I knew, you know.
I was, when I asked the question, I meant more really, how did it affect your, like you obviously, you joined the forces, right?
Well, I joined the Navy.
Changed the direction of your life, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, I would think that, apart from the awful aspects of it and losing people and so forth, and the monotony, most of it's monotonous, hours and hours of nothing, you know, an awful monotony, which is a tremendous waste of time. But in my case, when I did join the probationary or whatever it was in the Navy, I joined as a civilian, and I determined in my own mind, at least, that I was going to come out of the service as a civilian. Mm-hmm. And this was a deliberate effort on my part.
Oh. So when did you enlist then? And
well, I actually enlisted in, I'm not sure of the dates now, but I think it was sometime at 41 in Victoria, so as a probationary officer. And
with the Navy?
That's right.
Why did you choose the Navy?
Well, I'm sure that by this time I've been, like a lot of other friends, been mulling over the different things. We figured we would eventually be going anyway, whether you're in the Army or Air Force or Navy. So marching as such never really appealed to me. I'm not a flyer, and I had no desire to do no gliding or anything. So the thought of the Navy appealed to me, I guess. So no special reason other than that.
So what did you do when you're in the Navy?
What did I do?
Well,
you paraded for a period of time on a probationary period until you finally were accepted or otherwise, and then if you were, then in my case, I went to Royal Roads, and that was 4 months training. And during this time...
Officer training?
That's right. And during this time, you did everything. You know, you learned... you did all the things you were supposed to do, rowing at 6 o'clock in the morning, taking signals, taking the other types of seamanship training, and supposed officer training, and parade ground training, a certain amount of machine gun training, and other things like this.
Yes.
Whatever general nature, trying to cram in 4 months what they probably should have taken 4 years with.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, when you finished that, well, then you were probationary sub-lieutenant acting while I was holding or something, temper.
Where were you posted?
I thought you were going to ask me where I asked to be posted. What happened, a lot of people most of us wanted the sea tampons, so therefore you put down, destroyers or TMTVs and whatnot, and the very first posting I got was on the parade ground of a Squamish. So this was about the last place. Hmm?
Uh-huh. So you ended up at Esquimalt. What was your role at Esquimalt?
Well, I was doing training of seamen, stokers or whatever, in third class rates, what they call them, both in the instructional sense, plus playground work, plus special officers.
Mm-hmm.
taking them on.
What particular kind of instruction were you involved in?
Well, if you know anything about a gunnery school, that's where you come under. You come under field, what we call field training, and this encompasses drill on the parade deck. It encompasses the use of arms, small arms, rifles, and pistols, and so on. Plus, the elementaries of what a breech of a gun is, and how it fires, and what a layer does, what a trainer does, and what their position is, what a cap and the gun's functions are.
So basic training, then.
That's right. That's right. Anti-submarine. Basic training. That's right. That's terrible.
How come you ended up in training of men?
Well, I don't know. I guess I have a I have a certain bent for it. I've enjoyed working with people, so maybe that's just what happened. Anyway.
What were the steps, though, that would have led you, for example, into training at a base instead of going to sea?
Well, you have no decision on that. You were asked to, and when we were railroads, there's 120 and under training, you were asked to make a choice of 1 to 10 of what you wanted to do. So I put down, I wanted MTBs, service and MTBs, overseas, number one. I wanted destroyers, number two, or C. I wanted any sea time appointment, any place in the world, number three, etc. The last thing I wanted was training in Esquimalt, at least a training ashore.
Mm-hmm.
That's the last thing I want. So because I had put it on last, I got it. This was typical. A lot of stuff went on.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So it was a terrific disappointment to you if you try to work. I work hard at whatever I'm doing, and I did the best I could across the board in railroads, and so I was disappointed. No, okay, I can't do much about it. I'm posted. While I'm there, I try to do the best that I can do while I'm there. So I was there for a certain length of time. I get more and more frustrated. So then I went to my superior officer and asked for a transfer someplace, or I want to go to sea.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the Navy's all about. So mm-hmm. he said, well, just another week or two, and you'll get to sea.
Uh-huh.
So my next appointment was in charge of the rifle and pistol range at Comox, Vancouver.
Oh, yeah.
And it took me a long time to get to sea, but I finally got to sea.
Uh-huh. And what was your sea experience then here?
It was pretty good. I had some up this coast, including a little wee convoy to Aleutian Islands on this coast, and then I went worked out of Prince Rupert for a while.
Convoy duty?
Yeah. Eventually, I put in for another course, which was a short gunnery course, and this is another 4-month course at Cornwallis, Nova Scotia. And after that, you then become specialized, and you can only be used on your appointment comes from Ottawa. You have to be used either at sea or in some specialized gunnery situation. So then eventually, after several months more in Cornwallis, Nova Scotia, I finally got to join a convoy on the North Atlantic run for a little while. Yes, group gunnery officer.
I guess that'd be probably in the last year of the war, was it?
That's right. That's right.
Going back to when you were in the training establishment at Esquimalt, I wonder, did you UNTD started in 1943.
Yeah.
I wonder if you would have had any contact with the UNTD.
No, not a bit. Not a bit. No. Not a bit. No, I was in work, and it's just a matter of marking time. I knew nothing. I'd never heard of UNTD at all. I never knew what they were. I knew what Fishman's Reserve were. I knew the NR was, and so on. We were all VRs, you see. RCNVR.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was the... At the end of the war, there were 95,000, at least 100,000 in the Navy total, and I guess about 90,000 were RCNVR temp.
Mm-hmm. What do you find attractive about the Navy? What was your feeling about it?
I think it's the most fantastic experience that a person can have. Is that good enough? If you are prepared to go in with the attitude that you're going to contribute, you're going to learn something, and you're not going to start dishing it out until you've proven yourself capable of taking it. Now, there are a lot of people who get mixed up with that and resent the whole system or the discipline or whatever. But if you go in, as in the Navy, unlike the other services, or I should say unlike the others, maybe the Air Force is different, but in the Navy you are always an individual. And you always travel as an individual, and you join different units or establishments as an individual. Alan Speck goes as an individual on a draft to any ship or establishment forever, mm-hmm. his whole career. So he's part of a Navy, he's under the White Ensign, but he is very much an individual. And Alan Speck is whatever he is, leading seaman with his whatever he's got, and he joins a ship or an establishment as an individual.
Mm-hmm.
He's drafted that way, and he's appointed that way. Mm-hmm. So he's never lost in any regimental group at all. He's always very much an individual.
Mm-hmm.
And his papers go with him like that. His S-264 or S-206 goes with him like that. Mm-hmm. His whole history goes with him.
Yeah.
Now that's pretty good, because...
Say the Army, by contrast, because it's such a... massive organization. Is this right. Why you think the main difference is then?
Because well, if I belong to the DCR or the C-400s of Canada or something, mm-hmm. I'm part of that unit, am I not?
Yes.
But I travel as part of that unit for all time. I go to overseas. I go to Africa, wherever, and the whole unit gets drafted from Vancouver to Toronto to you can argue the other mm-hmm. way about that being tremendous. But you don't do that. You're in the Navy. If you're in the Navy, that's it. You're in the senior service and all silence and all that stuff. But you're part of the Navy, aren't you?
Yeah.
But Alan Speck goes and travels as an individual in the Navy, no matter how many years. Whether it's 50 years, he's always going as an individual. He gets his little kit bag and off he goes and he joins the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And when he arrives on board that ship, he reports on duty and he says, okay, there's your bunk. This is your coxswain and this is the number one and away you go. Your watch is this right now. And you're in the blue watch and everything, and that's where you hang up the action stakes. This is what you do. Good luck, etc. All right. Now, each ship is obviously different size, isn't it? Different shape, different personalities and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
Tremendous. Just mm-hmm. tremendous, because you're mixed up. If you get enough drafts, you're mixed up with a floating hotel or a floating people all the time, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
It's a separate entity, a little wee world, and it depends on how good the leadership is all around. And you have to learn in a confined space, thrown up and down sideways. Mm-hmm. You learn to live with different kinds of people and different ages and different quirks and without much sleep and without proper food and in confined space. And you learn a great deal about people in a very short period of time, and they learn a great deal about you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at all times, you know, however, that you're Alan Speck, and you're all, and nobody can draft you except on your own record and your own thing, and you join, maybe your next job would be in a cruiser. Maybe you'd be on a loan with the U.S. Navy, maybe you'd be on a loan with the Royal Navy, you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And depending upon the size of the ship, it depends upon what the spit and polish part of it is at sea. And when you get ashore, it's all spit and polish, wherever you get, any establishment.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're in a small ship, most of the time, the old man of the Canadian ships, he put his cap on when he went out to sea, and he wore his old shirt and tie, or no tie, or nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the rule in a small ship at sea.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is quite a strange experience for a young fellow to be exposed to, and you're expected to look after your own bunk, and your own hammock, or mick, or whatever we call it, and your own grog, or not grog. Your own training program, if you wanted some more money, you have to keep qualifying and so forth. So you were reported upon two ways all the time. One was your seamanship ability, or stoker, or your engineer officer ability, whatever it is, and so and recommended for further training, and you get more money all the time. And secondly was your total department as an individual.
Yes, yes.
It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, that's an interesting distinction you're making. So really, in summary then, what you cherished about the Navy above the Army then was the fact that you were an individual, not attached to our Navy.
Well, I was attached to a great big team, if you like,
yeah.
of the Navy. But this appealed to me personally, because I think
yes.
you could join, and then the challenge was there at each place you went to.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm prejudiced, obviously.
So, when were you discharged?
When was I discharged? 18 days after I started on my work.
This would be...
I don't know. January 22nd, 1946.
Mm-hmm. Would you describe how you got the position with the alumni?
Alumni?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was going to go back to the work, to the alumni work, that is the work I was doing before, and I dropped down to talk with them, and then I don't slam any doors, so I got home this night and saw this advertisement in the alumni magazine, Alumni Chronicle, advertising for a first full-time alumni secretary, starting salary $2,500 a year, and which is slightly less than Navy pay at that point, but not less than what I was making, would probably be made going back Balkans, where I worked before. So this sounded like an intriguing thing. I guess there's always something about being the first or anything that's a challenge. So I just simply put an application in and was interviewed by Ted Baines and Laura Lind and one or two others, and was given the position.
Mm-hmm. How long were you with the alumni?
8 years. Yeah. It became frustrated then.
1946 then to 1954. 54.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And I left alumni work May the 1st, 1954, and I joined the Alumni Life Insurance Company May the 3rd, 1954.
And you've been with them ever since?
That's right. Yeah, 20 years later.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a tremendous experience, UNTD, no question.
Yeah. How did you become involved with the UNTD?
Dr. Norman Ann McKenzie, president of the UBC at the time, called me over from the alumni office one day and said, Professor McElroy is retiring from his job, or wants to retire from his job as commanding officer of the UNTD-UBC. How would you like to take the job?
And what did you say?
Well, I was a lieutenant commander at that point in time and not that far away from him. I said, sure, I'd love to. What do you have to do? I forget the date on that, but it was about 1947, I guess. 47, yeah, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
I was with them 7 years.
Uh-huh. Can you remember what your impression was of the unit when you started as commanding officer?
Well, I remember some of the fellows were pretty sharp, and some of them weren't. Mm-hmm. They had a kind of a general attitude. I'm not being critical of anyone when I say this. A general attitude that it was time in, and if they got their 4 years in the wintertime and going to parades, they became a probationary officer in the Naval Reserve. And it didn't really matter how hard they worked at this at all, and there was no summer training anyway. So
2 weeks, wasn't there?
It was a pretty social thing. Huh?
Wasn't there 2 weeks in the summer?
Well, it might have been 2 weeks. I forget initially. Yes. It wasn't any great amount of time. It might have been 2 weeks. I honestly forget. Yeah. So it could be.
Very much compared to later on.
You can't do much. That's right. I think it probably was initially 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a 4-year program, and mm-hmm. two of the cadets that were involved at that time, who shall be nameless, had a very casual attitude towards this whole thing. And so I had a chat with them, and I gave them a further warning that if they didn't show up on a regular basis, then they would be drummed out of the unit. And I don't think they believed it. So they didn't wish to be concerned with this. So I said, well, okay, you're out. And both of the fathers phoned me up and wanted to see me. And I invited both of the fathers to come and see me. So they did. And after I had finished talking with them individually, they said, well, okay, you're right. And I think it's a very good thing that this has happened to my sons. In each case, my son. They were drummed out. Well, after that, there was less problems of whether we meant business or not in terms of wanting them to show up to praise in a sharp manner.
I see. How about the...
Not their fault, I guess. That's just on.
So, there was perhaps a looser attitude then when you entered.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we were lucky from there. There's a continuous battle in Ottawa all the time as to what support or not you're going to get for this offshoot, whatever this UNTD is, you see.
Yeah. I wanted to... that's... In 1962, the UNTD wrote up an official history of the UNTD.
Yeah.
And I'm going to quote something, and you can comment upon it. It says, there was a great deal of uncertainty after the war. about the UNTD.
That's right.
Can you elaborate on that then?
Oh, yeah. The University Naval Training Divisions were started, as you mentioned, in 1943. Mm-hmm. And they started, for the most part, through the universities deciding they should have three service opportunities instead of one. And no one in the Navy at that time could figure out whether or not the UNTD program was worthwhile from a training establishment to produce future officers for the reserve, which is the only justification for its existence as far as the Navy is concerned. And no one really wanted to have the UNTD program under their respective wing, whether it was DNR, that's the Director of Naval Reserves, or whether it was some other department in the Navy. No one really wanted them. They didn't know what to do with them anyway if they did get them. There weren't that many ships. They didn't know what the commitment of money might be for reserve for defense purposes anyway. So they were not satisfied that the program as it was, with a lacking of any professional training in the summertime, with 2 weeks, that was any real value anyway.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there was continuous fight. But fortunately for us, Commander Herbie Little caused meetings to be held once a year of all the commanding officers of the UNTDs across Canada, plus as many staff officers as could attend. And he sold the concept that the UNTD program should be a total reserve program, and it should be under the DNR, the Department, at least the Naval Reserve.
Uh-huh.
It should be run by DNR, and the DNR should make available in Hamilton on the Great Lakes ships available for summer training. And the cadets should be paid for the summer training, the University of Naval Training Cadets, and they should be on a par with the other cadets, officer training cadets, and all the cadets going. Plus the fact that if any reserve ships were available on either east or west coast, they should also be available for summer training for UNTD cadets. Well, that took him a little time to sell this concept to anyone, but he eventually did. And over a period of a few years, it developed into a very fine program in the summertime. And this also guaranteed summer employment, which is an important factor for university students on a reasonable pay. They didn't, not comparable what they would make for in forestry or logging or something, but it did guarantee them full 5 months summer training, or almost 5 months of pay. Well, this in turn meant that if they were going to have two or three summers of full-time summer training program, that it was not necessary to have 4 years of training in the wintertime. And it was quite debatable as to whether the wintertime program was any good or not. At the same time this is going on, the ROTP program was being introduced, if you recall, and the three services. So we automatically inherited whatever ROTP cadets or whatever they were called were on the campuses or campi. We also, the Navy also introduced a CW candidate program, which was a certain number of cadets from the lower deck to go right through universities under a special deal. And those people were also attached to the UNTD's concern to the different campuses in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
So there were fights back and forth for quite some time. Well, then they, as soon as they accept the concept of junior cadet status, then they automatically said that they were part and parcel of the Naval Reserve, and therefore they were junior officers in the Naval Reserve, mm-hmm. and therefore they were entitled to have their own mess, which we call a gun room. Well, then each of those universities in the wintertime then attempted to set up a gun room or get the use of the wardroom, which is the Naval Officers' Mess, for their cadets. We were lucky enough to, well, that's a long story, to get the gun room in Discovery,
mm-hmm.
HMCS Discovery. So this then meant we had a really nice place for the cadets themselves to have their own social functions with their girls, on occasion, just plus themselves, you see.
Yeah.
And this assisted in the wintertime, I'm quite sure, in esprit de corps or whatever you like.
Mm-hmm.
Then we got fussy when we eventually got a top flight program. We were getting fussier in who we took, and we were restricted in the quota anyway as to how many we could have.
Yeah.
So then we had, the selection boards were developed, and then this, in turn, through people like Professor Ed Bellier, who did a great deal of work on this, and others, terrific staff officers like Pete Thomas and others that became staff officers, mm-hmm. we got full-time help in the wintertime also to assist us in the program. And this, all these things meant that we were able to accept and then tell, accept a certain quota and then reject others, you see.
Yeah.
And we worked together very effectively with the other units on the campus, the Air Force and the OTC, and we became closer together all the time. We had tri-service ball and parade and all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked together also. If the Army had to fill their quota, they still had some other people, well, they would automatically send them to the Navy and the Air Force. We worked together on the recruiting in the, in the fall. Very, very fine. So yes, we had lots of problems. We were lucky enough to get together 1 week before they said we couldn't have it. So,
yeah.
I was lucky. And let me just add one thing. I was very fortunate in the type of people that worked with us. Really and truly, I really was.
People in at Discovery.
Dennis, maybe? No, Dennis Perns. I can't remember them, all the names, but many of the ex-naval officers that are on the campus are students. Taking courses, Dennis Burns, Frank Dayton, who was an engineer officer, plus a fly type, and then the CW guys that came to the university, Maynard, his name, to name one, gunner's mate, terrific. Yeah.
Your officer staff just came from then the retired, the veterans of the sea.
Plus the candidates going through, an ROTP, or going through under CW.
Yeah.
So one of the gunner's mates had 15 years in the Navy, and he was attending university. So he was right over one NCO, if you like, obviously.
Mm-hmm. That brings to mind the question, I wonder how the older, more seasoned Navy men, what kind of effect they had on the students who were just sort of fresh in the...
Well, I think it was a tremendous thing both ways. I think that the tremendous effect of the veteran students as a whole on the younger students and vice versa. I think it was a very exciting time to be on the university campus. While they were there, I really do.
Mm-hmm.
It was exciting both ways. I think that the veteran students were very appreciative of the opportunity, whether they were married or single, of going to university, for the most part.
Yes.
Oh yeah, and they might have treated these younger students as little kids and all that, but by the same token, the freshness and exuberance and enthusiasm of youngsters reflects itself on others, not just on the services, but on other activities in the campus.
Yeah.
We worked together in the War Memorial Gymnasium, for example, and that was a that was a complete all-student effort.
Yes.
And that went on for 2 or 3 years out there, and the Penn McLeod, I think, was the first of it, so on.
Judging by the high enrollment, it seems like there was really a lot of enthusiasm after the Second World War for the services, compared to the First World War, for sure.
Oh, yes, there was. But, well, there was no similar type of what I call a veteran's bill, I don't think, in World War I, and there wasn't the same interest in university education after World War I either, I don't think, as compared to World War II, you see. And the government of the day in World War II, they put through a meaningful program where there was not just tuition and help, but let's make it possible for them to take university training for tuition plus money plus allowances and kids' allowances and all that, plus housing. And Dr. Shrum went up and found some huts and put them on the campus, where nobody could find it. And you had a man like Dr. McKenzie as president at that time, who was a World War I vet and a tremendous individual. He had a lot of interest, but Colonel Harry Logan, people like that, tremendous.
In this official history, first to getting the gun room as a fluke, would that take you too long to describe?
I'm sorry, I missed your question.
In the official history, first to the acquiring the gun room was referred to as a fluke.
Yeah. Well, it was a fluke in the sense that I know what a gun room is. And I know that if a junior officer in the Navy, if they don't have quarters available to them in the form of a gun room, then they must provision must be made for them in the senior officer's mess, which the Navy is a wardroom. Well, you can rest assured there were lots of senior officers attached to HMCS Discovery in those days who wanted no part with a bunch of young kids, so to speak, coming into their wardroom. Well, Well, if they didn't financially support it, then to physically say it's okay with us with this room over here, and go ahead, and give them the blessing to have the gun room, well, then they would have been in the war room, which would, they wouldn't have been very happy with. So, by the same token, the cadets, I said, well, okay, if you want this gun room, you're going to have to work at it physically, ripping walls down and cleaning the mess up, and you're also going to have to go around, and I'll help you raise money from people that might wish to assist you in this regard. And there were some chancellors and other people like this that were happy to see initiative being displayed by students for a thing like this. So they gave them some financial support to build this gun room. Mm-hmm. So the, both the physical and financial support plus the donation from the wardroom from the Discovery made it possible for them to move in to a room down there, called a gun room, is still there down at Discovery. That's there that belongs to them.
But this was built on Navy property.
Yeah.
And wouldn't you have to get orders from above to get permission to do it?
No, but any Naval Reserve unit automatically has the right to have a wardroom and a gun room.
I see.
No, anyone, sir. And as long as you have a wardroom and a gun room in a Navy Reserve, that's permissible. They didn't change the rules until 1 week or 2 weeks after the gun room was completed. Then they said that the Naval Reserves across Canada are so small and there's so few people, and there's a bunch of nonsense making provisions for gun rooms as well as wardrooms. All the junior officers attached, Naval Reserves attached to any reserve establishment shall go into the wardroom. There shall be no more gun rooms.
I see.
In the Naval Reserves. Well, by the time they had done that, we had it. So we said, well, we have this. So since we've got it, we assume, since it's in existence prior to this deadline, it's perfectly right to keep it. Is that right? And they said, yes, that's okay.
Oh.
That's how we kept it.
Aye.
Which is pretty important.
Mm-hmm.
So we were lucky in the timing, that's all. Well, I guess did a lot of work. There really did.
Mm-hmm. The first annual parade and ball started in 1949.
Something like that, yeah.
In the official history, I'll refer to a cadet levy. Did you know?
Yeah, he's now a lawyer, barrister, solicitor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's tremendous. That's right. He did a tremendous job. Darrell S. Levy. He's captain levy. No, I think he's either commander or captain. I forget.
Mm-hmm.
But he's done a tremendous job. Gerald S. Levy, and he was XO, and he stayed with the Naval Reserve for years and years and years. He was executive officer of HMCS Discovery down here years later.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
Yeah.
What was the significance of starting these annual balls? Why were these annual dances?
Well, I think that the COs plus the staff officers, especially the staff officers, I guess, used to meet fairly regularly, you know. And on the campus, and I guess probably it was started in 1949. You can correct me on this, but I think it was probably started because of the opening the year before of the War Memorial Gymnasium. You see, it probably because for the War Memorial Gymnasium ceremonies, I'm quite sure it would be President McKinsey's suggestion and desire that there should be a tri-service parade to that and a ceremony by the three services in the dedication, which would be the case. And I think this probably at the end of that, somebody said, well, why don't we have a ball, you know.
I
don't know. I would give the Army credit. I would think that it probably was the OTC CO, which would be Bob Barner, I think would get the march for that. I think that they had the armies, the UBC armies was born of the Army out there, the OTC, so I would think they probably had were the instigators in the original sense of a tri-service ball, you know.
I see.
Definitely. Well, we had terrific cooperation. We would argue amongst ourselves on occasion about different things, but we had excellent cooperation between the three services, no question.
You seem to be quite concerned about the training. There is, for example, you wrote a report in 1951 saying that we have to continuously be reviewing the training programs.
Yeah.
making sure that, and you felt there's a real need to get feedback from the cadets who went through the training too, to see how they are finding it.
Well, it's difficult in the naval service to upgrade, I suppose, the total training that you could give anyone that's a university-trained person. Not the first summer, but maybe the second summer. Mm-hmm. And the criticism would be more that they weren't getting enough, there was too much monotony and there was not enough additional challenges being given to them, you know. Maybe we should have had programs where they were on the international scene being much more on fleet maneuvers with the U.S. Navy or that type of thing, or with the British Navy, the Royal Navy, and in a sense, in a naval sense. Or maybe we should be teaching them more different things of the Army or Air Force or the three services, you know. It's a difficult thing for me to try to recall specifically, but I would think, generally speaking, it was not, if not challenging enough and not sophisticated enough for them, that's all.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what the answer is, you know, since it's no longer here.
Okay. Another quote from this history says, "The key organization in the success of the UNTD was the Tri-Service Committee." This would be the Campus Tri-Service Committee.
Whose quote is this?
This is from the official history of the UNTD written in 1962. Perhaps I'm quoting.
I wouldn't buy that at all. Not during my time, anyway.
Because yeah, the key to
our success initially was the fact that we were lucky enough to have a lot of ex-naval officers on the campus going through as students. Secondly, that we were lucky that they've instituted the CW program, so we got two or three per year of top-flight serving naval personnel who were going through to get their commission. They had to go through universities. And these people were NCOs, or if you like sergeant majors or whatever in the Army sense. Yeah. They were going through universities. And I glommed on to those fellas for instruction, for training, down here in the wintertime. And the key to the rest of it was the upgrading of the summer training program that we got through the DNR, through Herbie Little, and yakking at the people down in Ottawa all the time.
Uh-huh.
No question in my mind about those things. And we were lucky in the gun room. Was a tremendous thing. We could be pretty choosy because the gun room, a Navy cadet that is part of a reserve, is entitled to all the privileges of a full junior officer, including whatever it is, including beer and wine or whatever, and his own place. And I would strongly suspect that this had a certain definite appeal to certain people on the campus. The Tri-Service Committee later on, sure, I would agree with that, but not initially. There's too many. I think the support given by Dr. McKenzie, by former Chancellor Eric Hammer, and others that gave, I forget how much money they gave towards that gun room personally, but the cadets went around themselves and got, the Navy cadets went around and got that, physically, personally, and they went down and built this thing, and that's where they were, you know, on the social functions where the UNTD cadets were there. That's where they were. That was their headquarters from week to week in the wintertime. You know, it belonged to them, and they had their own lock, you know. So I wouldn't buy that. I think that the competition between the three services, if you put it that way, I would agree, that was good too.
Uh-huh.
Sure, we tried each to excel, and we took it our turns in terms of, in the tri-service sense, yes. Mm-hmm. And the cooperation that we got from talking to one another, sure, all those things.
How about the existence of the COTC would have perhaps provided an example of here's a unit on campus which is being very successful, and this would have given you some kind of something to refer to when you were starting the UNTD after the war.
May I interject again, Alan? I disagree with that heartily, and here's
why. That's
my
opinion, not the official.
I disagree with it heartily. The reason being that I arranged with the commanding officer of HMCS Discovery, which was a complete naval establishment. And I said, look, you prayed on Tuesday nights. That's your regular parade night, right? And this first was McDonald's predecessor. And he said, right. I said, all right, now why can't we come down here and me sit in your chair and me take over the commanding officer's spot on Monday nights for our parade night, and my counterparts, an XO executive officer, sit in the XO's chair and the signal officer over the communications chair, and we just take, when we take over the base on Monday night, why can't we physically take over all the office space just the same way as it is now? And he said, contrary? Sure. Therefore, we simply moved in to a complete naval reserve unit. Uh-huh. And each of us serving in the Navy knows all about what we're supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. And all the procedural drills and everything else was automatic. We didn't need any reference to OTC or Air Force for any of that stuff at all. I wouldn't know what to do with it. Mm-hmm. And my program, or our program and training, was laid down by the department, you know, by Naval Service, not by anybody else. So if you were a cadet, we had our own selection board, no reference. We didn't require, we had finally had traveling selection board, which were all Navy. We had no non-Naval people serving on the selection board. Why would we? And so then each, if you were the executive, Jerry Levy was my executive officer to start, but he was in the executive officer's office at HMC at Discovery, and that's where he went, mm-hmm. on Monday night. So it was very simple, no necessity, because our training was done not on the campus at all. We didn't do any training on the campus. We did all the training down at Discovery in the wintertime, with the odd exception, I might say, well, look, we're going to have an oddball drill session in the Army, mission of the OTC tonight. But otherwise, no, we did all our training in the wintertime in HMCS Discovery. Mm-hmm. And we even used their old tender, the little wee ship, on weekends in the wintertime. See? We got permission to use that, so I'm not mocking OTC at all when I say that, but we survived and we improved by working together, sure. And we sold, I think, the students generally more in interesting themselves in the service life and the routine and what they could get out of it by working together, sure. And we enjoyed this being, and we were very proud to be part and parcel of the Tri-Service Parade and Ball any old time. And certainly I take my hats off to, Colonel Gordon Shrump and Dr. McKenzie and Colonel Lutzen and all the rest of them in the Army that started things in the first place. It wouldn't have been in the UNDD without Professor McElroy out there in the first place. Oh, yeah. But it's a different, we were lucky enough to be it's a different type of organization. The Army was never, and is not now, until not part of the reserve as such, you see. That's the difference. And the Army monies out there in the trust fund had to be set up in a special trust fund, which Colonel Shrum can tell you all about, separately. Well, that's not true of the Navy. The Navy money in the reserve, it doesn't matter where they, what part of the reserve it comes from, it's all part of the Naval Reserve. You see? No matter where it is in Canada, and, you're answerable under the auditor for it. Not some separate deal over here. Whereas the poor OTC in World War I had collected wave pay and all that, but they had to give it to the Army in the end. And Colonel Shrum overcame this by setting up a trustee plan from the Army. That's where the Army's came from, on the campus, which is the wave money was waived into that trustees plan, including the Navy students and the Air Force students, with not very much money. But in terms of the money down, or whatever, in Naval Reserve, it's a different setup. And I believe that was made it easier for us, a lot easier for us, because we were under only one thing, and that was the naval routine, whatever it was. And then as soon as we got under the Department of Naval Reserves, then we all knew who we came under directly in the Navy. Yeah. So maybe we'd get no help at all in summer training or winter training, but that's who we came under. Mm-hmm. So when he came under a visit, fine, there we go.
I would think, Bill, that the precedent of training, on officer training in the CRTC, would have been of value, that, you know, this was in existence and accepted by university, and there were university people who had been working with the officers training unit. So,
well, Alan, I don't know what you want me to say about this. If you want to say the example
well,
of men,
men
like Haynes, and a good friend of mine, or Ray Herbert, or Bob Bonner, or Harry Letson, or Harry Logan, or people of that ilk being an example, sure, they're all terrific examples.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as officer training in the Navy is concerned, you'll never, ever, ever hear any naval person at any time in history believe that you could train them any better than the system that they have, you see?
Okay.
That doesn't mean that they can't work with other people, or they don't enjoy working with other people.
Yes.
But, and it doesn't mean that there's any difference in the qualities that any one of the services are looking for. But I'm quite sure the Air Force felt exactly the same way as we did. They could train airmen the way they wanted because they were going to fly. Isn't that the object of eventually training them? They don't require some of the procedure drills that perhaps the Army does. And I'm quite sure if you talk to an Army man, they'd say, well, the only kind of officer training plan that's worth anything is the Army plan anyway. The rest of you are all subsidiaries. Isn't that right? If you didn't have this pride in service built into you and your own ability, then you would have difficulty in inculcating any pride in service. We had the best unit in Canada, I figure. You tell Herbie Little what year we had the best UNTD in Canada. And he said you had the best one from west of the Rockies, you know. sorry.
In this period, there was a magazine startup by the ABC UNTD.
Yeah, the cadets started it up. It ran for about 1 year, I think. But they started up just because they felt they would like to have their own magazine to once a year to produce something for their own self for once a year that they could look at, I guess, in future, and to describe what they did in the wintertime, what they did in the summertime. And then we used this magazine also in a recruiting program.
Mm.
Get some extra copies paid.
Yeah.
And we sold they did it. All the cadets did it. No one else. We didn't do it. The cadets worked it. I approved it or otherwise in the end, but they did all the editorial work. They did all the selling of advertising for that. Mm-hmm. See? And that was a tremendous experience, and they did the writing as well, the editorial writing, which was a tremendous experience for them.
Mm-hmm.
They got guest articles by the chancellor and the president and so on. And they got articles from the other OTC and the Air Force units as well, you know.
Mm-hmm. You were a commanding officer during really the high point of the units, certainly in terms of numbers. This is what I mean.
Could be.
Seen.
I don't know.
Because
I
the quotas weren't introduced until 1954-55.
Mm-hmm.
And you stepped down at that time. This is
well. Maybe it's only because, again, the timing was right, that's all. There were greater enrollment. There's a much greater percentage of Navy people on the campus are going through. And even when they finished, you see, I was able to say, well, come on, Jerry, you're finished, but I mean, what are you going to do? Well, how about staying on as cadet? The officer, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And parents or Dayton or whatever. So it's not hard if you're working with them, you know, to ask you to stay on. So they did.
Mm-hmm.
And quite a number of them, actually, like fellows like Peter Grantham, a medical doctor now, has stayed on the reserve. A good number of them have stayed on the reserve over the years, too.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, many, many years.
Mm-hmm. You did get quite a bit going to reserves, but, of course, one of the reasons for reducing the quotas, though, was because they weren't sure they were getting as many as they wanted.
That's right. It was a disappointment to the powers that be in terms of the percentages they got in the active reserves. And I said, well, okay, your problem is that it's difficult for young persons just starting out. He graduates from university, most likely gets married in a year or two, then he's in a career. And then he does not feel that he has the time to spend in the reserve. And he sure can't take time off from his work to go 4 or 5 months in the summertime training. So on the other hand, he is trained so that if something does come up, it's not going to be too tough to give him a refresher course, is it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
do you think the many cadets, so after they graduated and got established, would have perhaps started to come back to reserves?
Not very many, no.
No.
No, but I think that's a valid reason. It's the same as anything else. You know, you used to get married, you got two kids around the house, what are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
You're going to spend more and more time with your wife and kids and your job.
Yes. So how come you're...
I got to make... Go ahead.
Oh, you... can you tell me why you left UNTD? Or what were the circumstances?
I don't know. I served from 46 to 54, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I guess I had I'd had enough at that point in time, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, what can I do? I had long since been away from instruction, in a sense, so what am I going to do from there?
So you just felt, well, you'd like to leave and let someone else
I went to, I was leaving the campus anyway, and I left the campus, I practically speaking left the campus as I did, see. You can't hold that job as University Naval Training Division CO unless you're on the campus in some capacity.